We hope that you may pause in hearing this story tonight and think, yes, that happened to me, or more important, yes, I felt like that, or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. Okay, and with that, I'm going to let Terry get up here and introduce our speaker for tonight.
Oh. Hey, everybody, my name is Tarek, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Tarek.
About a year ago this time, I'm a CD junkie. I like listening to speakers off the internet. I stumbled across a workshop that Dave had done. And there were some areas in my life that I was struggling in, and there were areas in his life from listening to him that he was very strong in, and he was spiritually guided in those areas, and I was attracted to that. And I sent him an email, and he got back to me, and He started doing work on Skype, very open, an open heart to take me through this and share his experience with me, and I'm grateful for that. He's taught me a lot and will continue to do so. And last night he gave us a great talk. To me, it was about paying attention to the detail. We miss the miracle because we take credit, and he reminded me last night that so many things take place in our lives every day that are the power of God, and we miss the miracle by taking the credit, and I learned that from him last night, and I'm sure he's going to give us a powerful talk tonight. I give you Dave Fredrickson.
Good evening.
Hello.
I'm powerless over alcohol. My name is Dave Fredrickson.
Hey.
And I bring you greetings from Dallas, Texas. And my sponsor made me promise that I would let you guys know that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well in Texas, and we still follow the big book as outlined in the basic text. And one of the first things that I always do when I start a talk is I take my jacket off. So you saw it. You can tell my sponsor that you saw me dressed up. He says, you know, when you're speaking, you're representing the program. So I'll get comfortable what a great group. You know, it's great to see so many young people. I've been blessed in my sobriety. And to the newcomer, the guy with his first meeting, you know, awesome. I was telling we met each other in Starbucks before we came over here. And as we were walking out of the Starbucks, we were talking about it. I said, you know, his sister gets the Best Sister of the Year award in my book for bringing her little brother to his first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I mean, how awesome is that? Because of great people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, great sponsorship, I had phenomenal lineages, I had guys that were willing to take me through the work, great home groups and old-timers to pass the message on to me. By God's grace, I've been sober since December 5th, 1981, and for that I am eternally grateful. And I got here as a teenager, and I stand before you to let you know that relapse is not a requirement in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We pay such a hefty price to get our first time in these rooms. If you made it here, stay here. You know, one of my pet peeves from way back when was when I hear everybody go, keep coming back. You know, I got a hat from my buddy. On the front of it, he printed on the word stay. Because when I hear keep coming back, I'm always yelling, stay! Don't go back out. You've made it to the miracle. You're here with us. If we're doing our jobs right, we're going to capture you with the message of hope that's in these rooms. It's a really wonderful deal. When I got sober, the old-timers didn't like the fact that I was sober because I was a teenager. You know, and I used to hear things like, well, I spilled more beer down my chin than you ever drank, you know. Crap like that. So I used to say, well, if you were a better drinker like me, you'd have gotten here sooner. You know, but it was one of those deals. But to start out with, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic household. For what that's worth, you know, anybody that's grown up with addiction in their family, you know what that's like. The yelling and the screaming late at night. You know, I had the memories of my dad dragging my mom down the stairs by her hair and all the wonderful things that you get when you have a nice drinking household. But the one thing that I learned from growing up in that was the power that was in that bottle. And I wanted that power. Whatever it was, I wanted that. I didn't know what it was, but it was like I couldn't wait till my first opportunity to get a chance to drink. And because growing up in that household, it was one of those deals where any of you that grew up in a household like that, you knew that you kept the family secrets. You never talked about it with anybody. You just knew that something was wrong. You didn't quite know what was wrong, but you knew something was wrong. And that's why my earliest memories, I remember having that feeling, a hole inside of me, like everybody else knows what's going on except me. You know, everybody got the playbook to life except this kid. So I would sit in the back, and I was a pretty quick study, and I'd kind of figure out what was going on, and then I'd step up to the plate, and of course, then I'd always want to take the lead and be the king of the castle and do that sort of stuff. And it just was the way of life. But the problem was I had all these feelings inside from what was going on at home I didn't know how to express. And at a very young age, I realized that if I could act out, I could get attention. And if I couldn't get good attention, I'd get bad attention. So I was always a troublemaker. I was always getting in fights on the playground and always getting in trouble everywhere. And I was acting out and doing strange things, you know, like I brought live shotgun shells to kindergarten show and tell, you know. That's the kind of kid I was. I used to beat up everybody on the playground. So literally, they wouldn't let me out on the playground. I was assigned to the principal's office, you know. Everybody else would go out and play. And in the principal's office, there was this wonderful lady, and I always tell this piece of my story because I didn't feel this until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's this lady there. She didn't care that I was a troubled kid. She didn't care what was going on at home. She just exuded love, unconditional love, you know. And I remember going into that principal's office, and there was this lady, and she'd always give me a big hug. She'd say, "Come here, baby," and she'd suck me up and give me a big hug, and then she always had a job for me. And I just would light up, you know, and she'd say, "I want you to run the mimeograph machine." And I'll explain to you young ones what that is some other time. But I would crank the mimeograph machine, you know, and I would make the copies before the days of Xerox. It's that old. And I thrived because she was paying attention to me and she loved me. And I wouldn't sense that kind of unconditional love until I walked through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because our job here is to love the unlovable, you know. The guy that's just crapped his pants and puked down the front of him coming into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the kind of person I make the beeline for, because that's what I was raised with. And I'm embarrassed to tell the story, but not too long ago, I was at a meeting and I was running a few minutes late. And I hadn't been to this meeting in a long time. And I showed up at the meeting and this woman was drunk in the meeting. And I was maybe 5 minutes late and I walked in and the room was having a group conscience whether they were going to throw her out. Can't come here. Where can you go? For me, this was my last stop before I died. I didn't have any other avenues. I tried everything, and I could not figure this thing out. It's the only thing in life I couldn't sit back and figure out and then rise to the top was my drinking and drugging. I just couldn't do it, you know? And I hope from what I've seen, you know, last night I spoke at Spearheads, and there was a great group of young people there, you know, that were carrying the message. And I was like, wow, it gives me hope that maybe, God forbid, my kids need this, that its program's still going to be around, you know. And that's one of the reasons I don't go anywhere without a big book. You know, I was taught in the very early days, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in this thing. It's not coming to meetings. It's in this book. They changed it. It used to be on the third edition of the big book, the dust cover that everybody always gets rid of, a little piece of paper that tears. Inside the leaf, it said, pages 1 to 164, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He used to tell you that right on the book. When they printed the fourth edition, they got rid of the dust cover that said that. I still carry in my big book dust covers from third editions, just for that reason. Because when I start working with somebody in the program, the very first thing I do is take them to this. And you notice I said it starts with page 1 to 164. The first edition of the big book, page number 1 is the doctor's opinion. When they printed the second edition, they changed it to the Roman numerals. So a lot of people miss a huge section of the program. They miss a third of the first step, which is the physical craving, which is, in the doctor's opinion, valuable stuff. I'm so blessed that I had people that were willing to teach me that stuff when I got into the rooms. And so to see this many young people, it gives me so much hope to know that this program is still going to be around for years to come. Because you, at least a PPG group. I'm out in Dallas, Texas, where PPG started with Cliff Bishop and Myers Raymer and those guys. I still see those guys on a regular basis, you know. And we connect at a level because we're in the fellowship of the Spirit together. You know, and for those who are new in the program, the fellowship is not the same thing as the program. They're two completely separate things. And people interchange the words all the time, but they're not the same thing. The fellowship is when you walk through the door to your very first meeting and you feel like, ah, these are my people. You feel at home. There's that instant connection. Like, these people kind of know what I've been through. That feeling is fellowship. The program is working the 12 steps out of the book. That's a completely separate thing. When you work the 12 steps, you have a spiritual awakening. There's only one reason we're here, and it's not to stay sober. Let me say that again. There's one reason we're here, and it's not to stay sober. It is nothing about drugs and alcohol. It's, matter of fact, the book says that that's a symptom of the problem. We work the 12 steps, and the 12th step, it's hidden key in there. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result, we're here for one result, to wake up our spirits. It just so happens, because we're lucky, that if you have a spiritual awakening, the byproduct is you don't want to drink and drug. It's about the spirit. We come walking through the door as newcomers, at least I did, and I said, you know, guys, you don't understand. I had a problem with drugs and alcohol. And it was like a shell game. Everybody go in the city where they, you know, the three-card Monte games on the street corner. We do that here in the rooms. It's like a shell game. The guy comes walking in and says, I got this huge drinking and drug problem. And they go, okay, we can help you with that. And we go, find God. No, no, you don't understand. We turn it back around. We go, I'm here for my drinking and drug problem. We go, no. Go have a spiritual experience, and we'll take care of the drinking and drug problem. And it works for every other problem that you have in your life. How cool is that? Every single problem I have, I can solve it if I'm right spiritually. It takes care of itself. Because my problem is not drinking and drugs. I thought it was when I came in here. My problem, what does step one say? It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. So my problem is not alcohol. My problem is lack of power. So if lack of power is my problem, what is my solution? Power. The whole deal from step one to step 12 is about finding, removing the things that are blocking you off so that you can go have a relationship with the power within yourself. I didn't understand that. And when I was this young kid growing up, I had all these emotions inside. I was desperately seeking something, and the first thing that I found that fit inside me that solved that hole in my gut was drugs and alcohol. And the first time, I mean, I'm sure most of you had that first expression. When you take your very first hit or your very first drink, and what happens? You go, we've all had that experience. And you spend the rest of your days chasing that first high. You're like, wow, that was awesome. For me, it happened. My dad bought this farm, this crazy farm. He wanted to be a gentleman farmer, you know. So he'd go out there and he'd be plowing the fields. And I grew up in New Jersey, you know. And the glaciers came down in the Ice Age, and they dumped all the rocks that the ice had been picking up in it, and they dumped it in New Jersey. The little hills in New Jersey, they're all made out of rocks and clay. Why anybody want to be a farmer there? Beyond me. So some of my most favorite memories are my dad would say, hey, go out and throw rocks. So he'd plow the field, and then we'd have to go out there and pick up rocks all for hours and just chuck rocks. I'd be a professional pitcher, you know, with all my arm, you know. But at the end of the day, he always had two quarts of Pabst Blue Ribbon because the Pabst Brewery was in New Jersey. You know, my mother would always say, who's going to take the beer out to your father? And she always say it with kind of disdain in her voice. And I, of course, my hand would fly up. I'll do it. Because when Dad would start on the first quart, I got to start on the second quart. And I learned the magic of what's in that bottle. That, and I just couldn't wait till I could get some more of that stuff. You know? And it wasn't all bad growing up in that household. Sometimes it was good stuff. I mean, my dad, he loves Dixieland jazz. Why, I don't know. I guess he grew up with Dixieland jazz, but he loved it. In our town, there was this old gin mill that had Dixieland jazz bands. Famous bands would come to play in this little hole in Chester, New Jersey. And, of course, my dad was there, and believe it or not, he plays the kazoo. And he'd get up there, and he'd play the kazoo with all these famous Dixieland jazz people. And then, of course, when the bars would close, he'd say, hey, guys, come on back to my house. And he'd bring the whole band back to our house. We'd go out by our pond, and he'd build a big bonfire, and they'd have a keg of beer. And, of course, I was always the kid who would wake up, and I'd come downstairs, and I'd go out, and I'd join them. And I'd think, wow, look at this. It's an awesome party. And we did really cool things, you know. Like, we'd always go over to the next door neighbor farm, and we'd steal watermelons, you know. And so we'd be sitting out there eating watermelons and by the bonfire and having a great time. And I would remember the watermelon and the bonfire times, I wouldn't remember the one coming home from school and the panels and the, you know, the door panels where the top two panels and the bottom panel were missing because he punched the first two and then kicked the third one on the way out the door. We didn't see him for 2 weeks. I didn't remember that stuff. That's the way my mind works. My mind is broken. I always remember the good times. I don't remember the bad times. And it's just the way it goes. You know, and wonderful things, you know. I'll never forget, we had this party, and I don't remember what the party was, but my father got really hammered, and it seemed like a smart thing to do. He pours gasoline all over his boots. He goes upstairs in the loft, and he grabs one of those giant umbrellas, you know, that you have like over a table outside. He lights his shoes on fire, jumps out of the loft with the umbrella. Of course, the umbrella just goes straight down, pile drives into the ground, and he's rolling around everybody's kicking dirt on him, trying to put him out. My mind says, wow, that looked like so much fun. I can't wait till I can do that. You know? And if you're laughing, welcome to the club. You're one of us. Normal people don't think that way. That's how I think, you know? I wanted that stuff, so I couldn't wait till I could get that stuff. Now, in New Jersey, it sounds really strange, probably today, but until 9/11, they didn't have pictures on driver's licenses. They just had a description of you. So my older brother, the day he turned 18, I snuck into his room and stole his driver's license out of his wallet. Because at that point, we were identical. We're the description-wise, we're the same height, we're the same hair color, same eye color. I know his name and his address. They're not going to screw, you know, when they proof you, I'm not going to mess that up. Even drunk, I'll get those answers correct on that driver's license. So now I had a legal way to drink, you know. And let me back up. Right before my brother turned 18, my father got sober. Right? He came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I learned that if you want to see my dad, he was either at work or he was at an AA meeting. He went to AA meetings constantly, all the time, morning, noon, and night. He would be at an AA meeting if he was off work, you know. And he'd stay out late at night, and he'd come out in the morning, and, you know, he'd sit in his pajamas until it was time to go to a meeting, and boom. So if I wanted to see my dad, and one of my favorite things to do at that point would be get really hammered. It comes to an AA meeting, you know, because it was my people. I felt at home there. I felt okay in the fellowship, and nobody judged me. They knew I was, pardon my language, but they knew I was crap-faced, and they would just say, hey, come on in, kid. Welcome. Have a cup of coffee. I'm like, oh, no, thanks on the coffee, you know. And I just enjoyed listening to people. They were fun people, and they were telling the same stories that I had grew up with, watching my father do, you know. But now that I had this legal way to drink, I started going off and hanging out at the same bars my dad used to drink. And, you know, up until that point, other substances were much easier to get than alcohol as a kid growing up. You know, the first time I got arrested for dealing drugs, I was 13. Twice when I was 14. Twice when I was 15. I was headed down the path to juvie, you know. And then all of a sudden my older brother turns 18, and it's like, man, I'm not stupid. I can put that stuff down because that always gets you busted. I can go drink. Drinking's socially acceptable. It's the only legal poison in the world that you're allowed to go buy and ingest. And nobody says anything about it. As a matter of fact, they encourage it. Hey, have another one. You know? So I was off to the races, you know? And I wanted to get to the same level that my dad had. I wanted to have the fun. I wanted to have those experiences that I saw him having. I only remembered the good times. I didn't remember the bad times. It's funny how your mind works. And, you know, and the problem with that was my father knew all the tricks of the trade. I'd come walking in the house, you know, it'd be 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd come, you know, you'd be trying to do that tiptoe and the floors. The house we grew up in, it's like 1740s. It's this ancient house. And all the floors, you can't step anywhere in that house and it doesn't go on the floor. It creaks like crazy. You know, so you're trying to do that drunken tiptoe. And he was all the way back in the kitchen. And I knew he was there because the light was on. And I'd hear, David, no, not tonight. And you got this beam of light coming from the kitchen, and the whole rest of the house is dark. And you got the hallway, and you're trying to navigate the hallway and not bounce off the walls because you'll hear it, you know. And I literally just step into the light, and I go, "Hey, old man, how you doing?" And he'd say, "Where you been?" And I'd say, "Oh, just out with my friends." And then here it comes. "You've been drinking, haven't you?" I'm going, "How the hell does he know? I'm on the other side of the room." I'm embarrassed to say that I bet you I was 10 years sober before I figured out he knew that if I had been out, I had been drinking. Duh! It's not brain surgery. You know? And I did wonderful things. Like, you know, I was a real smart kid. Because now he doesn't need the booze. He had this wonderful liquor cabinet. So I did things like I look in there and I go, okay, I've already filled all these bottles half full with water. Anybody else do that trick? You know, everybody does that trick. But in the back of the liquor cabinet, there was this old, old, old dusty bottle. There was crap all over it. And I'm thinking, whatever that is, he's never going to miss it. It was like 55-year-old scotch. And even though he was sober, that bottle wasn't missing from that cabinet for more than maybe a week before he's like, who took my scotch? Luckily for me, I had an older brother who was 2 years older than me who was doing the exact same thing. So he didn't know who to blame, my brother Don or me. It wasn't until about a week later he figured out which one it was, because like a dummy, the Boy Scouts were camping across the street on our farm, because we would let the Boy Scouts come and do the campouts there. Of course, I took the bottle of scotch over there and got the scoutmaster's son absolutely puking drunk. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, he's banging on the door going, your son gave my son some drugs. What happened? My son, I need to take him to the hospital? And I'm going, oh, man, he can't hold his liquor. You know, busted one more time. I could tell stories like that all night long. You all understand where I'm coming from because you've all done it in one form or another. And it's not about the story. It's about what the alcohol did to you. It got me away from the way I was feeling inside. It filled that void, you know. And I don't care whether you drank beer or whether you drank wine or whether you drank hard liquor, you know. By the time I got done drinking, towards the end, all I cared about was proof. I was a proof drinker. Whatever is the most proof, just make this pain go away. And the problem was, the pain didn't go away. It numbed it, but it didn't go away. You could still feel it. And I was running after that thing, and I just could not get rid of that guilt and the shame and the remorse that I was carrying every single day, you know. So about my junior year, I figure out, if I want to get away from my dad, I'm going to have to get into college. So I went from straight D's and F's to straight A's and B's. Because when we're focused and we have a goal, you know, you could tell me, you know what, you can't have a drink for a year to achieve some goal. I could put it down for a year, no problem. But watch out, at 366 days, look out, I'm going to rip it up. Well, it was the same deal. If I have to suck up doing grades and studying for a year and a half in order to get into a college so I can go drink the way I wanted to, that's what I was going to do. You know, so I did. I managed to get into a college. You know, and it was 2,000 miles away from home, and that was my only requirement. Get me away from the old man, because I'm tired of getting busted. And once I got into college, I started to drink the way I really wanted to. The leashes were off. It was my first time away from home, and I could do whatever I wanted to do. And I did. Here's the problem. That hole that I was trying to fill, I couldn't fill it. It just wasn't fillable. And inside were still all those negative emotions that I've been carrying since I was a little teeny kid. And I became the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You put a couple shots in me, you know, and you could be my best friend in the world, and you bump into me and spill my drink, and I'd put you in the hospital. And I realized that I had this taste for bar fighting. I got off on it. I enjoyed it because it was the only way I could get rid of that negative energy, but it was just like drinking. I'd feel better for a few minutes, and then I'd see the damage that I'd done to another human being, and I'd feel, once again, that guilt and the shame. And when you're feeling that guilt and the shame, what do? Give me another one. Let's make it go away. So I'm either out of money or I'm passed out. You know, and then as soon as you wake up, you got to do it again because the pain's still with you. I had a little refrigerator that sat next to my bed. Because it got to the point where I could not get out of bed and go hit the target for that morning pee without having something, because I was shaking so bad. You know, so I'd look in it, and usually there was nothing in there because I drank it all the night before. And then I'd get on my hands and knees, I'd start crawling. The famous crawl is you crawl across the floor just looking for any of the leftovers. You know, and you find the old bottle, and you take your head off of it and spit out the cigarette butt that was floating in there. Whatever it took to get the hair of the dog so that I could hit the target. Because I'd be shaking so bad I couldn't hit the target, you know. And I used to think it was funny, but my roommates didn't, because I'd pee all over the place. I did wonderful things. I kicked them out of their own beds at 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, what are you doing in my bed? Get out of my bed, you know. And then you wake up and you look at it and you see, you know, like Lion King sheets. You're like, who the hell was this? Oh, wait a minute, these aren't mine. You know. I don't know. It wasn't lying. All I remember seeing was they weren't my sheets. I recognized it, you know. And it's one of the few times I didn't have to roll over and say, who is there? You know, I got to the point where literally, a lot of times, I'd have to get up and I wouldn't know where I was. I'd literally go look out the window, you know, and have to figure out, looking for a license plate, what state am I in? That's not a healthy way to drink. I'm a blackout drinker. I'm a mad dog drinker. I got to the point where I was homeless. For a while, I slept on a friend of mine. He let me sleep on the floor of his closet. His roommate hated me But as soon as his roommate would go to bed, I'd sneak into the room and I'd sleep. I'd move his shoes away and I'd sleep on the floor of his closet until I got busted at that. And then I went and lived under the bridge, you know, eating out of garbage cans. It's no way to live. But I was willing to do it to chase after that. Let's make the pain go away. You know, it's amazing what we'll do to make that pain go away. So, long story short, I got into fights, lots of fights. And my last series of fights, I don't even remember them. You know, I was really kind of pissed off because my roommates didn't want to drink with me. God knows why. And so I shot a bottle of 151 rum by myself, and I was just to get me lubed up and we're going to go party. And I ended up getting very violent and beat up a whole bunch of roommates, and I got cold cocked. And I was standing at the top of a set of stairs, and I went down the stairs, and I landed on my face on concrete, and it crushed my skull. And then I took off into the desert and got hit a barbed wire fence. It's a long story, and I'm not going to bore you with it. The deal is, with the blood alcohol content I had, by the time they got me to the hospital, I went into a coma. And when I came out of the coma, the first person that I called was the man that I said that I never wanted to be like. And I called my dad. See, my twin sister and I were born on my father. Sure. My twin sister and I were born on my dad's birthday. So we have three birthdays the same. And my dad had flown 2,000 miles out to Arizona for my birthday on October 19th. And I said, you know, I didn't invite you guys. I'm going out with my friends drinking. And so I was drinking at the bar at the same restaurant that they were having dinner, the birthday dinner that I was supposed to be there for. And it was like a knife sticking in my guts. I did not draw a sober breath from October 19th until December 5th. When I came out of the coma, you know, and here's the man that I absolutely hated. He was the first guy I called. And it was my first lesson on service in this program, because my dad was there and he went to the local meetings and he said, I'm either going to need pallbearers or I need somebody to 12-step my kid. I don't know which. And within an hour, members of AA were in intensive care by my bedside, and they nursed me back enough to get me on an airplane, and I flew home, and they cast my entire head because my face was so broken. You could touched the side of my face, and literally my nose would slide across my face. It was really brutal. That kind of sound as it slid back and forth. So they cast my entire head. So I'm the only guy I've ever met. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was truly anonymous. You know, all you knew was my name was Dave and I had blue eyes. That was it. You know? But I got into this program, and my brother had beat me by 2 months. My older brother was 2 years older than I. He'd gotten sober. He drank his way out of school, too. So he was in meetings, and we were unemployable. And so we did what we had learned from my father. We'd get up in the morning, and we'd go to an AA meeting. We'd come back for about an hour, or we'd go to the arcade and play arcade games. And then we'd go to a lunchtime meeting. And all the lunchtime meetings were what were called eating meetings, because all the business people did only have an hour for lunch. And so they'd show up, and they would be like sandwiches, or somebody would bake a casserole, whatever. And so we'd go there, and we'd have a free lunch at the meeting, you know, and then we'd go spend some more time, and then we'd come back for an evening meeting, you know, and if it was a Friday or Saturday night, we'd go to a midnight meeting, you know. So some days we're doing four meetings because we had nothing else to do. And one day this guy comes up to me and he says, hey, you guys have a job? I said, no. And he goes, well, you do now. And he says, you guys have a sponsor? No. He says, what do you do now? Well, and this guy, Carl, kind of took me under his wing. And I didn't have to ask him to be my sponsor. He basically, in those days, they told you, I'm your sponsor. I later found out, I think, that they drew straws because nobody really wanted us, like my brother and I, because we were the only two young people around. So nobody really wanted to deal with us. But everybody on Carl's crew was in the program. So going to work for Carl, everybody there was like nine of us, and we were all in the rooms. And so it was program all day long. You know, you could drop a 16-inch block because he was a mason. You could drop a 16-inch block on your shoe, and you'd be hopping around, and you'd hear, easy does it. You know, and you just want to jump up there and strangle them, you know. But they taught me about how to control my emotions, and they taught me about my anger. You know, and at lunchtime, we'd all go find some shade, and we'd sit under a tree or whatever, and we'd have a meeting when we were having lunch together. And we always finished early with Carl. And so we'd finish early, you know, like 4 or 5 o'clock at the latest, and he'd drive us back to the house because we didn't have cars. We were unemployable, right? We didn't have no money. So he'd drive us home, he'd say, hey, get a shower, I'll be back in about an hour and pick you up, and we're going to a meeting. And so he picked me up, and he'd take me, we'd have a meeting on the way to the meeting, we'd have a meeting on the way home from the meeting, after we had a meeting at the meeting. You know, so I was getting immersed in recovery, you know, and we started through the steps, you know. Step one I could handle, no problem. Unmanageability, I got that, piece of cake. I got kind of hung up on step two, because I didn't believe in God. I was afraid of God, I didn't know about God. Terrified. And it was one of those deals where I didn't trust anybody to even ask anybody about God. You know, so I just kind of hung out there. I said, I know I'm powerless, and I'll just kind of see how it goes. And if I was in a meeting and people were talking about God, I'd get up and I'd go smoke a cigarette and, you know, drink a Coke or whatever and come back in and hope they were done talking about that God crap, right? That's where my life was. And then one day my older brother Don comes and he says, hey, I'm going to go do my fifth step. And I went, your fifth step? Well, you didn't say I'm a little competitive. There's no way my brother is going to do a fifth step before I'm going to do a fifth step. So I said, who are you going to do your fifth step with? He says, oh, this old guy Leo. And I go, I know Leo. So I get on the phone, I call Leo, I say, hey, Leo, you know, I need to do a fifth step. And he's like, okay. He tells me, and I said, well, how about if I do it with you tomorrow? And he's like, oh, that'll work, great. And he tells me where he lives, downtown next to the church. And so I show up to do this fifth step. Now, mind you, I haven't done step two, three, four. I haven't done any of that. I'm just gonna beat my brother to the fifth step. So I can say, hey, I did my fifth step, you know. I knock on the door. He opens up the door, and he's wearing a collar. And I said, Leo, where are you going, a costume party? And he says, no, I'm a priest. Talk about fear. Somebody that doesn't believe in God or the existence of anything, who doesn't know anything about it, and there's a Catholic priest standing in front of you, it scared me to death. He's like, ah, don't worry about it. Come on in. Unconditional love, right? You love the unlovable. Coolest priest in the world. He gave me an ashtray. He's like, come on, you want a cup of coffee? Have a Coke, sit down, smoke them if you got them. And I thought, it, you know, you tell your life story, right? That's what I thought it was. So I tell him all this life story, and you know, and he's like, well, who's your sponsor? And I told him, and he's like, maybe you should talk to Carl and come back and see me again. He says, because you really should have something written to do this properly. I said, okay, now, I'm not stupid. I'm not going to talk to Carl about anything. If he knows I went, I'm in trouble. If he finds out I was out trying to do a fifth step before I'd ever done any of the first four steps, you know, I'm not going to humble myself to tell him this. So the second time I show up to see Leo, I spent about a couple minutes in the car with an envelope, in the back of an envelope, and I wrote down what I thought was supposed to be a fourth step, and I go in there and I fifth stepped at it. And finally he says, you know, this time I think maybe I'll call Carl and set it up for you. Why do I tell that story? I always tell that story. Because even though my motives were wrong, and I wasn't doing the steps as they were written, I was doing something. And I stayed sober. As screwed up as I was, and if I can do it that screwed up, every person in this room can do it. You know? And I'm still here today. It wasn't until my third time through the steps, actually my first time with Carl, but my third attempt at a four-step inventory that I actually did the columns the way they're written in the book. You know? And I'm still here. And so Carl was, he was a dream. You know, he understood that I didn't understand anything about God and I was scared of God. And it's cold, right? We're driving and the sun is coming up over the horizon and we're driving over the Black River. I'll never forget it. And it's one of those days where the water is warmer than the air and so there's this fog, this mist coming off and the sunrise, it's the first break of sunrise. Carl cranks the window down his old beat up truck and the heater doesn't work in the truck so it's freezing in there to begin with. Cold, it's like 20 degrees. And he's waving out the window. I'm like, Carl, you're out of your mind. Close the window. What are you doing? He said, I'm waving to God. And here's a guy that I trust with my life. Because at that point, I got him to really trust Carl because I knew his heart was in the right place. And he believes in God. You know? So a couple of weeks later, I'm talking with my brother. And we're out walking out behind the barn, out towards the pond. And we'd just been to a meeting, and it was all about spirituality. And I said, you don't really believe this God crap. What a terrible meeting that was. And he stopped, and he squared off to me. Which, guys don't square off to each other unless you're going to throw down. And I thought for sure we're going to get in a fist fight. And he got right up in my grill, and he's basically looked at me and he says, oh no, I believe in God. Now here is my own flesh and blood, my own brother, and he believes in God? And it cracked the door for me. The two people that I trusted the most in the world, both of them believe in God. And Carl's was the Mother Nature. And he started me out small, because he knew I could handle small. Because it was a beautiful, picturesque scene. And every time Carl would see one of those, he'd say, hey, look at that. Look at God today. What a gift God gave to us. And slowly but surely, I was able to come to believe in a power greater than myself. I didn't understand it. That's the cool thing. We don't have to understand God. You're never going to understand God. You just have to believe that he's got more power than you do. And the steps will work. It's a neat, neat deal. So he took me through the inventory, and life got really, really good. And I don't want to waste a whole bunch of time talking about that piece of it because what I want you to hear is my life got better than I could ever imagine. Because since I was about this age, that man that I said I never wanted to be like, my dad was an airline pilot and the gentleman farmer on the weekends. And I'd always wanted, since I was about 4 years old, to be a pilot. But I'm a convicted drug dealer. So I went and got myself through college, and I was working construction during the day, and I was going to night school at the county college, and then I got a 2-year degree, and I transferred that to another university, and I got a 4-year degree, and then I went to the military. And what did I learn in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Rigorous honesty. So they were filling out the forms, and they said, have you ever used drugs? And I checked the box and said yes, and told them when and how much and where and why, and I figured, well, we'll see what happens, and I doubt they'll ever take me. Sure enough, it had been longer than 7 years. And they said, sure, you can get a security clearance. I got into the military. I'm like, cool. They hired me to go. They spent $1 million sending me to pilot training to fly supersonic airplanes. I was like, this is so cool. Life was getting really, really good. While I was at college, I'd met a girl. Now, mind you, I used to cripple shoot in meetings. You know, the meat markets, you guys know what I'm talking about. And I'll never forget it. Jim McCabe. Big old, fat old Jim McCabe. One of the old timers. He had like 35 years when I was brand new in the program. And I showed up at Jim McCabe's meeting, and it was a big book meeting on the weekend, and I'll never forget it. He walked up to me, and he poked me in the chest, and he says, boy, I see you looking at the girls, especially that one over there. And I go, yeah, isn't she hot? Long thing to say to Jim McCabe. He says, you know, I'm fat and old. And I'm shaking my head, and he goes, but I'll get some of these young books, and we'll kick your ass. You don't look at the women. You give them a chance to get sober. Don't you dare look at the women. So I'm a smart guy. I stopped going to Jim's meeting. Right? I don't say that with pride. I damaged some women. I had to make amends to some women in the rooms. Give them a chance. And women, give the guys a chance to get this program because your life literally depends upon it. It's one of the 4 times the big book says you're going to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. If you continue to harm people in the sexual arena, knowing that it's the wrong thing to do. I used to call it strafing, because I only had one thing in mind. As soon as I get that girl's knickers off, man, boom, I'm out the door. Next one. You know, and we have this radar amongst ourselves. We can tell the damaged ones, you know. Absolutely. And it's even more dangerous if they know that they're damaged, because they put out that little damage signal so that you'll come, you know, because they're doing the exact same thing to you that you're trying to do to them, you know. And if you're laughing, you've probably had that conversation at some point. Oh, no, honey, I don't want a relationship. We'll just have sex, you know. We'll just keep it platonic like that, you know. You don't understand the word platonic if that's what you're after, right? But that's the kind of thing I was doing. Until I had a spiritual awakening. And then I realized, if I continue to do that behavior, guess what came back? That same sick feeling. It was back. I can't do that to another human being anymore. So I go to college, and I meet this girl, and I know she's a freshman, because I knew every girl on campus. It was a small little school, and I see this girl, she's walking across the parking lot, and I go, oh, fresh meat. In the back of my mind, I hear Carl's voice, and he's taught me about a sex ideal, and I'm like, oh, how's this going to work? You know, and she smiled at me, and I'm going, I'm going to find her tonight. And so I went to the first, that's where I was at, I'm telling you the truth. You know I am. I found her, and something came over me, and I said, you know what? If there's any chance this is ever going to work out, you need to know something about me. I'm a recovered alcoholic, I got almost 4 years in sobriety, and I had a terrible drinking problem, and you need to know that up front. And she, you know what? She didn't run away. She's like, okay. I was like, wow, this is kind of cool. We became friends. That woman, it was the first time that I didn't do a hit and run in sobriety. And we've been married now for, I better get this right, this year will be 25 years. Right? Yeah, it'll be 25 years this year. I did a lot of drugs. It's hard. At times it's really hard. You know. So, like I said, my life got really good. So I'm married, and I'm in the military, and I'm doing my dream job. And the day I got off active duty, I got a job with the airlines. But here's the problem, folks. I stopped doing the inventory the way Carl had taught me to do. Right? And I'm still working with newcomers because I know that's my lifeblood. I got to carry this message. That's our primary purpose. But rather than taking through the book the way I was taking through the book and giving them the gift that was given to me, I'd say, go read the first step out of the 12x12, and then I'll take you through the work. You know, so I was sending them to the 12x12. Well, that wasn't written until 55. You try to work the steps out of that book, you're going to die. But if you try to find the first step in this book, you better know where it is or you'll go right past it, you know? So my life was getting good. I was shortchanging the people in the rooms, you know, and I'm taking credit for my sobriety. And I had double-digit sobriety. And one day I'm cleaning my service weapon, and I know there's a round in the chamber because I want it to look like it's going to be an accident so the insurance will pay to my wife, because I had gotten so miserable because I was shortchanging recovery rooms, and that pit in my stomach, that guilt, that shame and remorse was there. And I was just too chicken to blow my head off because my whole wife came home early. If you don't believe in the power greater than yourself, there's no reason. She hadn't been home early in years, and I hear, "Hi, honey, I'm home." And I immediately put the gun down. I dodged the bullet one more time, you know. A couple weeks later, I'm over in Europe. I'm flying to Milan, and I'm an instructor for the airlines, and my arrogance was beyond. It was off the charts, you know. I was God's gift to aviation. I knew everything. You couldn't tell me a damn thing. I got it was my favorite expression. Oh, I got it, right? And I'm flying with this crew, and my arrogance had gotten to the point where the captain looked at me and he goes, "Dave, just sit down and shut up. I'm so sick of you, I'm done with you." You know? And we took off out of Milan, and we're heading back to New York, and I see him making a mistake. And I tried to say something to him, and he turned around and he said, "Sit down and shut up. I told you, shut up." So I tried to tell the other guy that's flying with us. And he's not going to be about to get between me and the captain. No way. And so he's not paying attention either. And we missed flying into the side of the Alps. Several hundred people on board, by 800 feet, in a full stall, in a 747. I used to blame that captain. It's not his fault. It was my fault. I had made myself completely unusable to that crew because of my arrogance, because I wasn't sober. I was dry. I was living in sobriety, not sobriety. Emotional sobriety is where you need to be. If you don't feel that life is happy, joyous, and free, you're missing this deal, you know? And when I landed at Kennedy Airport, I had to ask God at every single exit, "Help me not pull off and get drunk." I can't tell you the pain, the emotional pain, because I had no excuse. I didn't have alcohol and drugs to point at. I was 10 or 11 years sober at that, or dry at that point. I knew better, and I was still doing the same crap. There was no excuse. So I drove for the first time in uniform to my home group, and once again, the unconditional love. They just let me cry for the entire meeting. You know, it started a series of hearings, and the whole nine yards is another long story. I told it last night. You can get the tape and listen to it. I managed to get through that thing. And when the dust settled, the one thing I had learned was you tell the truth. And I told the truth. When they asked me what happened, I told the truth. The company said, "We're going to fire you unless this comes out." I said, "This is what happened." Everybody else was trying to cover their ass and was lying through their teeth. And when they finally figured out what the truth was, they fired everybody else. And they gave me a letter of commendation in my file. And once again, I took credit for it. It's like, wow, I dodged this bullet. But God's got a sense of humor. Remember I said I was in the military? Like a week later, the phone rings. And they said, "Is this Lieutenant Fredrickson?" I said, "Yeah, it is." He said, "You were hereby activated." I'm in the reserves. "We don't go to war. Are you kidding me?" Here comes the Gulf War, right? "Hey, honey, guess what? Here's the bills. Here's everything else. I'll see you when I see you. I don't know." But Carl had taught me well. In my helmet bag, I carried a big book and a 12-12. I'd always carried it with me, wherever I was, because you don't go anywhere. I was taught, I don't go anywhere without this thing. Just as these guys, you know, we're going in Starbucks, I'm like, "Hey, do I need to bring my big book?" You know? I always carry a big book with me, because you never know where you're going to walk into a 12-step call. Never. It just happens all over the place. I've had 12-step calls. I had a 12-step call in Washington, D.C., in a closet at the airport one day. Amazing 12-step call. It's a whole other story. So I go through the Gulf War, right? And we're in this Gulf War, and we're descending into a military base that we believe is under Scud attack, under chemical attack. And everybody's freaking out, trying to put on their chem gear. And I reached into my helmet bag, and I don't know what possessed me, but I pulled out my big book. And it flopped open to the third step prayer. And for the first time in my life, I truly meant what it said, and I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Now, I'm not stupid. I put on my chem gear. But when I got back home, I realized the mistakes I had been making. So I had to go to every one of those guys that I had shortchanged and say, hey, let me take you through the steps. Let me give you this gift. Do me the honor of making amends to you. And I went back and I humbled myself and I took them through the work the way it was outlined in the big book, the way I had been taught. And they're like, hey, I got a sponsee. That was really awesome, but could you show me how to do it with my sponsee? So then I'm taking guys through two at a time and then three at a time and then five. And then there's 25 people. And then a taper comes and I started doing these big book workshops and I started going all over the country doing these workshops. And life gets really cool when you start doing workshops. But once again, if you're going to do that, if you ever get on, have a chance to get on the speaking circuit, number one, it's a very, very dangerous place. If you watch how many people die that come on the speaking circuit, because they start talking about experience, it's old experience. I make sure that I'm up here and I talk about current experience from the podium. You know, one of my favorite expressions is, even the monkey falls out of the tree once in a while. If you've got any kind of time under your belt, and you're going to make a mistake. Life is going to happen. And one of the things Carl taught me is you got to bleed on the tables. So if I screw up, I'll be the first guy to say, you know what, I screwed up in my own group. I'll talk about it. But the rooms are not a dumping ground. We don't care that your shoelace broke. We don't care that your car got repossessed. We don't care about that unless you talk to us and finish the story. Oh, my car got repossessed. But here's what I did. I had to write a resentment inventory, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and I fifth-stepped it, and now I'm spiritually free. Then it's okay, because you're not dumping in the meeting. I hear so many times people come in here, and they just dump their problem. And guess what? You see them again the next week, and they dump the exact same problem. They're taking the spirituality out of the meeting, and they're using it like a spiritual filling station. Ever see that? You ever see somebody been in a meeting where somebody walks in and goes, oh, I really needed a meeting. I'm so glad I got here. Okay, wasn't God out there with you? You know, if you're doing this deal, I went to survival school in POW school in the Air Force. I didn't catch a meeting for months because I was in these schools getting tortured. I didn't think about getting drunk. You know what? Because every morning I'd get up and I'd do my prayer and meditation. It kept me sane because it gave me something to focus on when I was in those schools. I take my higher power with me wherever I go, you know. The purpose for meetings is outlined in this book. It's twofold. It's a place to meet newcomers, right? And it's a place to have the fellowship. We replace our drinking with the fellowship, which is not the program. We already talked about that, right? So meetings are a wonderful, wonderful deal. I'm not saying don't go to meetings. What I'm saying is come to the meetings prepared to share about the working and reworking of the 12 steps or to talk about having had a spiritual awakening. That's what this deal is about. So when I'm in the meetings, that's what I'm sharing. I'm sharing these big book workshops, and one day my phone rings, and it's this guy. He says, hey, are you Dave Fredrickson, the guy I'm listening to on tape? And I said, yeah, probably. And we started up a friendship, right? And it's another long story. Once again, get the tape from last night. You'll hear the rest of the story. I got a phone call about 2 years after that from somebody at my company. And they said, hey, are you Dave Fredrickson that we're listening to on tape? And it's a guy in management. And they said, probably. He says, I want you to take over the drug and alcohol program for Maryland. I said, cool. Because one of the things he knew was the Air Force knew I was sober. And the Air Force had come to me and said, hey, we want you to help set up the drug and alcohol rehabilitation program for pilots that have drinking problems in the Air Force. And I said, sure, I'll help you do that. Cool. The FAA came to me and they said, hey, we'd like you to teach the FAA drug and alcohol school. And I said, sure, not a problem. So I went down to my airline and started teaching pilots who have this disease how to get sober. But here's the thing. I didn't do it. All I taught them was apply Big Book, how to work the 12 steps. And you know what? The highest recorded sobriety rate that's ever been recorded, 97% recovery rate at 1 year, 95% recovery rate at 5 years. And for the life of the program, it was above 90% recovery rate. Relapse is not a requirement if you do what's in this book. And like I said, you don't have to do it right. Just do something, you know. And if you don't know where the steps in the program are in this book, grab one, some of the people around here that do, because I know that there's one sitting right here. Nobody else will help you. Talk to him, and he'll help you. I'll help you on Skype, you know. That's how we do our step work. I took a guy through in the Ukraine not too long ago, right? He contacted me from a workshop that I did in 2001 in New York. He got a hold of those tapes, He called me. He said, take me through the works. I took him through the work, right? That crazy SOB translated that workshop into Russian. I was dumbfounded. It's lightened people up. They're desperate for the message. And now it's in their language. And one of the things we discovered is their big book, whoever translated the Russian big book, it's not the same words as our big book. So they were having trouble with the spiritual concepts. And so we started talking about the spiritual concepts. And it was amazing to watch this guy light up when he started talking about his relationship with God. It was just one of the coolest experiences. Don't miss that experience. It is like the light of your life. Once again, I stand before you happy, joyous, and free. But there's a price to be paid for sobriety. Desire is not good enough. If you look in the book on the top of page 24, it'll say that the most powerful desire in the world is of absolutely no avail. But what do we hear in traditions? It says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So what does desire buy you? A chair at a closed meeting. That's it. If you have a desire to stop drinking, you can come into a closed meeting. Period. It takes something more than desire to get sobriety. There's a price that has to be paid. And the answer, I'll shortchange it for you. The destruction of self. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the same as what marriage is designed for. A close, intimate relationship. It's designed to kill you. I'm serious. The death of self. You have to have a servant's heart. But what do we hear in the rooms? We hear, oh, it's a selfish program. Show me where that is in this book. Show me in any of our literature where it says it's a selfish program. I can show you at least 50 places that it says it's a selfless program. It's selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, it's what kills us is selfishness. And for me to think that I can be selfish over here and not be selfish over here, it doesn't work that way, right? We have to do the whole deal. What are we walking the doors for? I came here to get the monkey off my back. You guys handle the drugs and alcohol. I'll take care of the girlfriends and the money and the career. I got all that. You just get rid of this deal. That's not the deal we're doing. Remember the show game? The deal here is, you want to get sober? Give us your life. Right? When I do big book workshops, I usually tell the drunk parable, right? And it's the guy, he's walking down the street, and he's really, his life is just falling apart, and he finally cries out to God, and he says, God, help me. And he hears, yes. He said, God? Yes. He says, God, I need help. I really need help. Do you have 20 bucks? 20 bucks? Why? Well, do you have 20 bucks? He says, yeah, but I need the 20 bucks to buy gas for my car. Oh, you have a car? Well, yeah. How do you think I'm going to get home? He says, you have a home? Well, yeah, that's where my wife and kids live. You have a wife and kids? He says, yeah, I have a wife and kids. What are you talking about? He says, well, give them all to me. That's what this program is. We have to give the whole thing to God, and guess what? He gives us back the wife and kids. He gives us back the house. He gives us back the job. He gives us back the car so that we can take care of his kids. Because it's not my wife. It's his kid. It's not my kids. They're his kids. It's not my job. It's an opportunity for service, according to our literature. I think the job is to go get money. It's not my money. I am the steward of God's money. I'm running out of time, but I'll say this, tell you this story. A couple years ago, I was walking through London, and it was a beautiful day. And once again, get the tape from last night. You can hear the whole story. But I slipped on black ice, and I broke my back. The one thing that I loved more than anything is flying airplanes. Because for me, you take off and we fly and you get above the crowd. I don't care what kind of day, it can be nasty like you guys had the other day. Tornadoes and rain and it's ugly. You break through those clouds and there's these columns of thunderstorm and the light show is beyond belief, the lightning going back and forth. And I get to fly across the Atlantic to in the Pacific to Tokyo and down to South America and I'm going over to Europe all the time and I have the aurora borealis and the shooting stars. If you can't find God watching that, talk about a spiritual experience. And now I got a broken back. And I lose my license, so I can't fly airplanes. I lost my identity. Because one of the first things, if you'd ask me, what do you do? Tell me about yourself. I would tell you, I'm a pilot. I'm not a pilot. That's what I do for a living. I'm a child of God. I'm a servant. I carry the message. That's who I am. That's my identity. You know, I'm sober for a reason. The price of my sobriety is I have to carry this message to the next sick and suffering alcoholic, the guy that's just crapped his pants and just puked down the front. I'm going to go to that guy, wrap him up in my arms and say, come on, let me get you a cup of coffee. Let me help clean you up. You know? It's amazing what happens. Inner Group has my phone number. I don't know how many of you guys are registered with Inner Group, but every one of you should be registered with Inner Group. In Inner Group, sometimes they have to call 20 or 30 people to get somebody to go on a 12-step call. And they're astounded. They'll call me back. Because they call me and they say, hey, we've got a 12-step call. And I go, okay, I got it. Give me the name and address. Done. And I've actually had them call me back a day or two later and go, that never happens. We called you and you said yes right away. What's up? And I said, well, I've been at this a long time. You know, that's the way you do it. I was taught old school. I've actually taken drunks into my upstairs in my house in detox. I'm not recommending this. If you've never done it, you haven't trained at it, you'll kill somebody. Detox somebody in my house. Take them through the 12 steps, boom, and they're sober. We're spoiled today because we have detoxes. When I got sober, the detoxes weren't everywhere. You had to go to the emergency room for a detox. Rehabs were really expensive. It wasn't until insurance started paying for rehab treatment that a lot of people started going through rehabs. And the problem with rehabs, and they're wonderful institutions, you hear a lot of half-truths. And one of the biggest dangers to this room is half-truths. How many people in this room have ever heard the expression, the meter makers make it? My home group, in the last year, we buried three people from my home group, where I know the message is. Regular meeting attenders. Meeting makers don't make it if you don't do the work. You will not make it. There's a price to be paid to own this chair, right? I hear it all the time, and it drives me crazy, you know? Well, it's progress, not perfection. Half-truth, folks. That's not the quote. We claim spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. So when you're cheating on your taxes, and you just went down and cheated on your wife, and you rented a whore, and you're doing porn, right, and you're up all night doing porn, and then you come into the room and say, well, it's progress, not perfection. What are you looking for? You're looking for somebody to co-sign your bullshit. Don't do that in my meeting, because I'm going to call you on it every time. You tell me where hookers and porn are spiritual, and I'll give you the pass.
Yeah.
That's my deal. If it ain't spiritual, it's not part of this program. It's not okay. Why? Because I've lived it. Because if you're doing that stuff, you get the sick hole in your stomach. You get the guilt and the shame and the remorse, and there's only one way that I know to make that go away. There's a cycle, an alcoholic cycle. And one of the things, I'm doing a workshop tomorrow afternoon for 4 hours. And I titled the workshop, Missing the Miracles. Missing the gift of what this program has to offer. Because there's some consistent themes I'm seeing, especially in young people. They're coming in and they're where the life preserver is floating right next to them, and they're drowning in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a crime. Because they're missing certain basic pieces, because nobody's willing to tell you the truth. I care more, I love you so much, I care more about telling you the truth than hurting your feelings. Just ask Tarek. He's called me up sometimes, and I'll say, hey, that's bullcrap, man. Everything after but is bullshit. That's what I was taught by Carl. Because he'll say, yeah, but, and I go, stop right there. You know, have you talked to God about it? Have you written some inventory? Everything goes back to God. And sponsorship, we're failing in sponsorship. I take guys through the work, and within the longest recently, in probably the last 5 years, the guy had three months before he had a sponsor. I get you sponsoring immediately. Why? Because that's our legacy, right? How much time did Eddie Thatcher have when he went and sponsored Bill? About 2 months. I'm not exactly sure of the dates. How much time did Bill have before he went and sponsored Dr. Bob? 6 months. But in the interim, he'd been trying. He was trying to shove the program up people's backside, and it wasn't working. And right, talk about coincidences, right? I call them coincidence gods. He went back and saw Dr. Silkworth, and Dr. Silkworth said, stop cramming it up people's lives. Just tell them the malady, like I told you. Guess where he was going the next day? Out to Ohio. He goes and sees Dr. Bob, and the first guy he doesn't shove it up there is Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob gets sober. Dr. Bob had 2 weeks sober before Bill Dodson, alcoholic number three. These guys were sponsoring right out of the starting gate. What does it say in here? It says right in here, and if you don't believe me, I'll show it to you. It says, in the early days of convalescence, let the man work with newcomers as much as he would like. Nothing will ensure drinking than that. It's an insurance against getting drunk. It's carrying the message. If you're one page ahead of the next guy in this book, you have experience and you can share it with the next guy, and you will stay sober. Everybody's worried about, well, I might hurt them. You can't do any worse than what they were doing to themselves out there. Are you kidding me? You know? And you're not here. All you are is a hollow bone. If anybody's walked the Red Road, the Native Americans, they call it, they say you need to be a hollow bone. And what they mean by that is you need to clean out the marrow so that God can work through you. You're just a conduit. You know, you're going to carry the message. You lay the spiritual toolkit at their feet. Whether they pick up the message or not, you don't care. It's not your deal. Because you're laying the spiritual toolkit at their feet, and you're staying sober. It's another one of those shell games. You carry the message to help the other guy, and guess what? The byproduct is you stay sober. The same way that if you go see God, the byproduct is you stay sober. It's one of the crazy things about this program. I stand before you as I consider myself one of the luckiest men in the world. I'm still sober all these years later, 31 years. All my friends, they're gone. They're all dead. All the guys I used to run with, why am I still here? You know, I was in the Gulf War for my 10-year high school reunion. I went to my 20-year high school reunion, and my wife got sick of people at my high school reunion because it was comical after a while. Because everybody would walk up and they'd go, Dave Fredrickson, you're still alive? And they'd say, yeah, I'm sober today. You know, I've 12-stepped a bunch of guys from my high school class. There's a reason that God chose me to be around. It's not so I can earn a lot of money and do what I want to do and have a little chippy on the side and do whatever. You know, that's not the deal of life. The deal of life is, are you making the world a better place because you're in it and you're sober? This morning we're having breakfast at some place here in Atlanta, and this woman comes up and she's our waitress, and she's got sparkly eyes. She's a live soul. And I engage her. I'm like, hey, how you doing this morning? And she's like, fine. I'm wearing a sweatshirt, and on the sweatshirt it says FOTSBBS. She goes, what is that? You heard me call myself a mad dog? It's the Mad Dog Fellowship of the Spirit Big Book Study. So I said, it's the Mad Dog Fellowship of the Big Book Study. She goes, I'm in that fellowship too. So we give each other a high five. She's like, a lot of people in here are. People were coming over to our table from the back in the kitchen. They're like, hey, I hear you guys are friends of Bill's, and we're having a meeting. We had a meeting in the middle of the breakfast place. Why? Because we're alive. We're a channel. We can share God's love that's inside of us because we're not, the pit is filled. And I don't have to jam drugs and alcohol in to fill that pit. You put God in there and you can become a radiator. You can shine this program out into the world. Life is like a pond. You can take a negative stone and throw it in the pond. Just watch what happens. Remember, any alcoholic that's been in your life and they come home and they're in that bad mood, and next thing you know, it radiates through you, everybody's life. As our book says, we're like the tornadoes rolling through people's lives. The same counter is true also. You can throw a positive stone into the world today, and you can change the 7-Eleven clerk's day. They're having a lousy day. The guy that was in front of them just chewed them out, and you walk up and you go, hey, man, how you doing? And they're like, fine. Say, no. Really, how you doing? And you see the smile come on their face, and they're like, wow. And you have a little tete-a-tete for a minute and 30 seconds, and you walk away, and their life is better because you're sober. Don't miss that experience. It's the coolest thing in the world. I got program babies that have never seen me drink. They'll tell you, every night we say the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, the ninth step prayer, the 11th step prayer. They know this program inside and out. And they're two of the coolest people in the world because they were raised on this program. They know it like it's second nature to them. I don't do Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're doing AA, you're doing it wrong. You don't do AA. AA is a way of life. If you can separate AA from your life, you're doing it wrong. It needs to be your life. And what it comes with is the greatest payoff in the world. You will know happy and joyousness and freedom like you never existed. You'll have peace and serenity. If you don't believe me, come walk a couple days with me and watch what goes on in my life. I am such a blessed person. I thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for you guys inviting a drunk like me, an old dipsomaniac, to come in and talk to you guys. I really appreciate it. You know, if I can ever be of assistance to you, let me know. If you got nothing to do tomorrow, come on out to the workshop. I guarantee you, I'll shake your foundation You know, and then after that, I think they're speaking to me every single night. I'm at, the fifth tradition or something after that, tomorrow night. You know, so my voice is going to be pretty shoddy, but we're going to be talking about the real deal. And that's the deal. I will tell you the truth, because I care more about saving your life than worrying about hurting your feelings. Thank you, and God bless.